Dave could see what was happening from the rear turret, and he reckoned the water spout went up to about 1,000 feet. And he said, and that's not all. In the downflow, some of the water came into the turret. I thought I was going to be bloody drowned as well as knocked around by you lot.
That was Johnny Johnson, Britain's last dambuster, recalling the night of the iconic raid.
What was interesting is that when we said to some of the locals, you know, are you surprised that we found loads of bodies on this beach? No, they weren't surprised at all. There are local stories associated of ghosts on that beach.
And that was Sam Willis on some grisly archaeology discoveries in Antigua. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Rob Attar and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. See historyextra.com/subscribe for subscription deals. We also have digital editions available for the iPad, the Kindle Fire and Google Play. For details of all our digital formats, please head to historyextra.com/digital. On the 17th of May 1943, 133 aircrew set off on the now legendary Dambusters raid. 70 years later, just 3 participants of the raid survive, and only one of them, George Johnny Johnson, lives in Britain today. So for me, it was a great honour to visit Johnny at his home close to Bristol and have the opportunity to hear about his wartime experiences. Johnny volunteered to join the RAF in the summer of 1940, while still a teenager. He went to the United States to be trained as a pilot, but unfortunately didn't quite make the grade. He returned to the UK early in 1942, still determined to be involved in the air war, and so he trained as a gunner. After several raids, he retrained again, this time as a bomb aimer, and it was in this capacity that he would play his part in the Dambusters raid. He first served as a bomb aimer in 97 Squadron, and it was here that he encountered the American pilot, Joe McCarthy.
And then I was told I was going to join this crew with an American captain. I thought, oh my God, bloody Americans again. But when we met, he was, I discovered, one flight lieutenant, Joe McCarthy. He was 6'3" and as broad almost as he was tall. Big in height, big in personality, but by the grace of God, big in pilotability too. Perfect. A great pilot, he really was. And it just happened that from the time we met, we just seemed to gel. And it stayed like that throughout the whole of the time that I was flying with him and extended into post-war friendship. I never at any time had anything but confidence in that he would bring us back from wherever we were going. I never felt that I wasn't going to come back throughout the whole of that time.
In early 1943, Wing Commander Guy Gibson asked Joe McCarthy if he and his crew would join a special squadron that he was putting together. It was an exciting opportunity for Johnny, but also nearly scuppered his wedding.
The score at that stage was that after a first tour of 30 trips, you got a week's leave, and then you went on to either a ground tour or a non-operational flying tour until you were wanted back on ops again. Well, since anticipation of this leave, my fiancée and I had arranged to get married on the 3rd of April. And before that happened, Gibson rang Joe, Joe McCarthy, who was my skipper, and said, would he be prepared to join this special squadron that he was forming for one special trip, just the one special trip? And Joe said, I'll have to ask my crew. Which he did, and we said, yes, we'd go with him. So I wrote to Grin and said, we were going to this new squadron for just one trip. Don't worry, I'll be there. And I got a letter back which said, if you're not there on the 3rd of April, don't bother. That's the first mandate issued. We went up to Scampton on the 27th of March, as I recall. And one of the first things we heard when we got there was, no leave. Oh, God, now I'm in real trouble. Joe took us up to Gibson's office as a crew. And his inimitable American style said, we've just finished our first tour. We're entitled to a week's leave. My bomb aimer's supposed to be getting married on the 3rd of April, and he's going to get married on the 3rd of April. We got our leave, and I got my wedding. But I thought, if flight attendant thought Gibson like that and get away with it was something. But then I gather that they had met before, sometime before, and Joe and Gibson had been quite impressed with Joe, which is why he asked him if he joined the squadron. So I got my wedding and that was that.
At this stage, the crew still weren't fully aware of what the operation would entail. But the nature of the training suggested it would be very different to the kind of raids that Johnny had been on before.
Probably the most interesting thing was that he was going to be low-flying. And low-flying meant 100 feet. Well, having spent the last 30 missions at 10, 12, 15,000 feet, if you're lucky, above cloud and in the darkness, which is our bombings in the outer moon, and seeing nothing until you got within target range, then you saw all the guns that you've got to go through before you got back. What a change to be told that you're going to be flying at 100 feet. Now, in the bombers compartment, which I had was the most comfortable compartment in the aircraft, I had the cushions to lie down on in the first place and the shoulder cushion to rest on. Lying there, watching the ground just going flashing past, was absolutely exhilarating, it really was. And one thing that worried me a little bit was that one of our routes was over the Spalding Tulips field. And as we flew over, the poor old tulips just went flop straight over. There must have been a hell of a lot of compensation claimed on that, because knowing Lincolnshire farmers, they wouldn't allow that sort of loss without making some considerable claim for it.
One thing that was made very clear to the crews was that security on this raid would be stringently enforced.
The other thing that was stressed was the question of security. Letters were censored, and even the public telephone box outside the station was monitored. And there was one particular evening meeting when Gibson really tore a young Canadian pilot officer to pieces because he'd run his girlfriend in Lincoln the night before and said, sorry, he couldn't make it, we'd got something wrong. That was sufficient for Gibson, breach of security. We were left in no doubt about what security was about.
The training continued, and Johnny and the crew learned to adapt to the unusual methods to be used on this raid.
The next thing was the arrival of the special aircraft. He had no mid-upper turret, and it looked as though the bomb bay was sealed, and it had these two arms sticking down in the front. One of them had a beveled wheel on the end. And then the bomb arrived, and it just looked like a glorified dustbin. Black, cylindrical, bloody great thing. And it became obvious what these arms were for. They were going to pivot on that bomb and hold it. And the wheel on the pin, the leg, built connected to a small engine within the bomb bay itself. So we tried to fly in these particular aircraft, without the bomb on, of course. And we had no navigational aids as such, because at that light, G was inoperative, so it was all map reading. And then the navigator and the bomb owner each had a map with the route marked on. Some crews cut their maps just to the width of the route itself, just and put it on a roller and undid it as they went along. But our navigator said, you know, he didn't think that was a good idea, because if by any chance we got badly off track, we wouldn't know where the hell we were or how to find ourselves. So we stuck with our map with just the track marked on. And he would suggest what we might be seeing. I would look for it. If I found it, I'd tell him where it was. If not, I'd say, no, it wasn't there, but I'd find something that was. And so he could plot that and adjust his course accordingly. And that was the way we did our navigation. The other thing that had happened was that bomb aimers had to make their own bomb sites. And this consisted of a triangle of plywood with a pin in each, or a peg in each of the corners. But the distance between the two base corners had to be specific, and the distance from the base to the apex pin had to be specific. Why? God only knows, because we had no idea what the target was going to be. And on our bombing range, instead of the normal bombing target, two poles were erected, and they again were a specific distance apart. And the briefing was that you held the single pin to your eye and you directed the aircraft until the base pins were in line with those two poles. Then is where you release your practice bombs. It was basically a ranging device rather than a sighting device.
Johnny's crew took part in several practice raids on dams in Britain, some of them in simulated nighttime conditions. But it wasn't until the operation was almost upon them that Johnny and the others discovered exactly what the targets were and about how the bouncing bombs would operate.
On the Saturday evening of the 15th, Barnes Wallace showed us the film of his development of the bouncing bomb, what had gone through it, how he'd developed it. And at that stage, the detailed dropping conditions were mentioned. It had to be revolved backwards at 500 revolutions a minute. It had to be dropped from 60 feet at a speed of 220 knots. Under those conditions, it would bounce across the water until it just rested against the dam, then rolled down the dam and exploded at a depth, I'm sure I was briefed, a depth of 25 feet. Most of the books quote 30 feet, but however, whatever. But it also told that it had two depth fuses set at the same height, but it also had a self-destruct fuse. So that if you had to jettison it anywhere other than over the water, it would explode and the Germans wouldn't have a copy of it. So that was that. So that started the conjecture about what the target might be. And of course, the popular choice was the German battleships, notably the Tirpitz. About 3 o'clock on the following day, Sunday, Tannoy message, all 617's air crew to the operations room. And there we learned what the target was to be. How wrong can you be? When we went into the ops room, there were two models there. One of the Mohun Dam, one of the Zorpa Dam. The one of the Ada hadn't been completed, so it couldn't be there. At that particular briefing, the AOC was there, the station commander was there, Gibson, of course, was there, Barnes Wallace was there, so were all the specialist officers, engineering, armament, and even dear old Met officer, hoping he was going to give the right sort of forecast. Gibson did the briefing. There was a map on the walls, which showed two routes out and one route back to the three dams. There are two routes out. The first route out was going on the southern route. Second route, the second group, would go the northern route, the impression being given to the Germans that a bigger attack was being made somewhere. The briefing was that Gibson would take off with two other aircraft and they would head for the Mohun Dam. They would be followed by another six who would go for the Mohun Dam. If they were needed there, they would be used on the Mohun Dam. If not, they would go on to the Ada Dam. The next five aircraft, in fact, they were the second wave, were going on the northern route, and they were going to the Zorpa Dam. The Zorpa was very different from the other two. A, it had no towers. B, it was so placed in the hills that you couldn't make a head-on attack to it. Not only that, but it was totally different construction. It had a central concrete core, and it was banked on either side with a tremendous covering of earth shingle, quite a distance away from the central column. And then it was concrete again along the outside. And because of its position and lack of towers, we couldn't make that sort of attack. And so it had to be, we were briefed, we had to fly with the port outer engine over the dam itself and fly along the dam and estimate to drop the bomb, inert drum, you weren't spinning it at all, estimate to drop it as near as possible to the centre of the dam. No sighting device as such, basically by guess and by God, trying to get as close as you could.
Just prior to the raid, Johnny recalls how some of the other aircrew took a pessimistic view of their own chances of survival.
I'm aware that there were one or two crews who felt they weren't going to come back. One of those was Hobby Hopwood, who was a very active member of the squadron. And he said to Dave Shannon, as they were going out to the aircraft, "Look, Dave, I've written a letter, left in my room. He said, I have a feeling I'm not coming back. If I don't come back, will you please get the letter and destroy it? I don't want them to get it first. He didn't come back. He was actually shot up, making his attack on the moon. And he burst into flames as he was shot up and crashed.
On the 17th of May, 1943, 617 Squadron set off on Operation Chastise. As they prepared to depart, Johnny's crew discovered they had a problem with their aircraft.
We got out of our aircraft. Two Queen had been our aircraft for training, and it behaved perfectly throughout the training. But it decided it didn't want to go that night, and so it developed a hydraulic leak, which couldn't be fixed at the time. There was only one reserve aircraft. It had only arrived on the station at 3 o'clock that afternoon. It had been bombed up, fueled up, and it had done a compass swing with the bomb on. So when our aircraft wasn't going, Joe said, for Christ's sake, get that reserve aircraft quickly before some other bugger gets there and we don't get a chance to go. So off we shot. And in his rush, Joe caught his parachute handle and pulled his parachute. So he was waffling behind him all the way out to the reserve aircraft. There was a truck there. Navigator got in and says, the compass card's not here. And Joe was really furious by now. So he got into the truck and drove back to the flight. Fortunately, the squadron manager was there, Humphreys, great character. And Joe was in an absolute rage. He said, for Christ's sake, Joe, calm down. If you don't calm down, we'll bugger the whole thing up. He managed to get him to calm down a bit. And the squadron visit, Flight Sergeant Powell, Chiefy Powell, shot across the flights and collected the compass card. But he heard Joe say that he wasn't going to bother with the parachute. And so he went off to the parachute section, came back with another parachute and said, put it in the truck and said, your parachute, sir. So that was that.
Eventually the crew took off and flew towards their target, the Zorpa Dam. On their way to the dam, they had an encounter with a German train.
We were flying just south of Ham, and this train was coming along, a goods train coming along at right angles to our track. And because we had no mid-upper turret, the mid-upper gunner was flying in the front turret, and they fitted stirrups so he wasn't constantly kicking me in the back. But when he saw this goods train, he said, can I have a go, Joe? And I think I'm convinced, almost reluctantly, Joe said, well, yeah, all right. So Ron opened up with his little 303s at this goods train. Of course, what we didn't know was that it wasn't just a good train, it was an armoured goods train. And it replied with rather more than 303s. We knew we'd been hit because we heard it and we felt it. But it didn't seem to impede the aircraft at all, so we just pressed on.
After surviving that close shave, Johnny's crew approached their target, the Zorpa Dam.
We eventually found Zorpa. It was a bit difficult to find in the end because it was becoming quite misty in the area. But over the dam itself, it was perfectly clear, brilliant moonlight. And one thing we noticed when we got there that we hadn't either noticed on the model and hadn't been mentioned at briefing was that there's a church steeple on the side of the hill from which we had to make the attack. So how the hell did we get around that? A bit dotty wing up just to get over the top and so on, but Joe decided to use it as a marker and go straight down from there. It wasn't very easy. Oh, what I should have said, because we weren't spinning the bomb, none of the dropping conditions applied. It didn't matter about the height or the speed. So the idea, as I say, was to get the aircraft down with the port engine over the dam itself, which meant that the bomb was on the water side of the dam, and then aim to drop it as near as you could to the centre of the dam. Not an easy manoeuvre, and one, of course, which we hadn't practised before at all. So the first were obviously practice runs, had to be. If I wasn't satisfied, I called dummy run. If Joe wasn't satisfied, he just pulled away and left me to call dummy run. I discovered how to become the most unpopular member of the crew in double quick time. Our squadron humorist was Dave Roger in the rear corridor, a Canadian. And after the sixth or seventh dummy run, voice from the rear turret, well, somebody get that bum out of here. However, nothing had been said between Joe and myself. But I'm sure we both realised that the lower we got, the less forward travel that bomb was going to have before it hit the water. And again, the lower we got, the easier it would be to estimate a reasonably accurate bombing dropping point. So on the 10th rung, we were down to 30 feet, and I dropped the bomb. When I said, "Bomb gone," "Thank Christ," came from the rear turret. So we circled around and had another look. I didn't see what happened on the explosion, because as soon as I said "bomb gone," of course it was nose up before we hit the hills on the other side, which wouldn't have been a very good idea. And again, Dave could see what was happening from the rear turret, and he reckoned the water spout went up to about 1,000 feet. And he said, "And that's not all. In the downflow, some of the water came into the turret. I thought I was going to be bloody drowned, as well as knocked around by you lot." Eventually, Joe was quite happy with what little success we'd had. Barnes Wallace had said he estimated that it would take at least 6 bombs to crack that dam. He said, "If you can crack it, the water pressure will do the rest." And seeing the amount of water that was in that dam, that wasn't surprising. What we couldn't understand was that when we got there, none of the other 5 aircraft were there, and none of them arrived whilst we were there. But having circled for a while, Dave said to Joe, "For Christ's sake, get down at this height. We're sitting duck for any fighters they care to send down." So he went down and set course for home.
Flying back from the Zorpa, Johnny flew over what had once been the Mern Dam.
It was just like an inland sea. There was water everywhere. We knew, of course, it had been breached because we'd heard the broadcast, or in its broadcast. And we also knew that the Ada had been breached through the same source. But water was still coming out of that dam, and that must have been perhaps 20 minutes, maybe half an hour, since the dam had been breached. But it really was. It was actually a very satisfying sight from our point of view. See, at least what had been achieved, even though we may not have been able to achieve the same thing at the Zorpa.
Johnny's crew arrived back in Britain safely, but found that landing was trickier than they had anticipated.
Scampton at that stage was still a grass airfield, so landings were always a bit rough. But ours was rather rougher than rough, and we were starboard wing low. The engineer, looking out of the perspex, said, "We've got a burst tyre skipper." So very carefully, Joe taxied it around. We ultimately discovered that the shot that we'd felt had gone through the starboard undercarriage, had burst a tyre en route, had gone through the wing of the aircraft, and had lodged in the roof just above the navigator's head. How lucky can you get? Another matter, certainly little feet, maybe inches, and it would have been into the petrol tank, and that would have been bye-bye McCarthy's crew.
After landing, the crew were debriefed, and there they found out more about what had happened to some of the other crews on the raid.
Then we discovered why we were the only one, 5, that had been to Zorpa. Les Monroe had been so badly shot up going over the islands on the way in that not only had the aircraft suffered but amongst the aircraft damage that had been suffered, the whole of his communication system, internal and external, had been wiped out. And since this was primarily a communications exercise, he had to, virtually by passing notes to each other, say, "Sorry, lads, we'll have to go back." So they came back. Jeff Rice, flying low over the Zuider Zee to avoid flak, admitted subsequently that he was fool enough not to watch his altimeter. And he got so low, he got the bomb in the water and ripped it off the aircraft. And he went back under the aircraft, didn't do the aircraft any good at all, and amongst other things, ripped off the tailwheel and overturned the ensign at the end back of the aircraft. And the contents of that flowed into the rear gunner's turret. He wasn't very pleased about that either. The Elson, I should have said, he wasn't very pleased about that. However, they both got home. Jeff was coming in on his approach, and he saw this other aircraft going in underneath him, just ahead of him. Christ, what's happening here? So he had to stagger round again. And the other aircraft, of course, was Les Monroe. He had no means of communicating with the tower, so he just had to go in. And he still got a bomb on. He shouldn't have had, but he still kept it. And he landed, and Jeffrey Finchley landed behind him. The other two, one had been shot down, and the other one had hit electric cables and crashed into the field just ahead. And the bomb had come off and rolled down the hill, but it didn't explode. And the only reason I could think of for that was at that stage, the bomb aimer hadn't fused the bombs. And fusing was done from the bomb aimer's panel. And the normal practice was to fuse bombs on crossing the enemy coast. He obviously was waiting until he got close to the target before he went to drop his bomb. I suppose the tragedy of the night was that the 19 aircraft that took off, two had to abort, which meant 17 had gone on target while bound. Of those 17, 8 were lost. That was nearly a 50% loss. Of those 8 crews, only 2 members actually survived. The third one died after escape. 53 aircrew lost that night, which was very, very difficult to take. Barnes Wallace actually cried. He said, "I have killed all those young men." And Gibson tried to pacify him a little bit. He said, "No, Barnes, you didn't kill them. Without you, that raid could never have taken place, and what has been achieved could never have been achieved." He said, "Whenever we took off on any of these raids, we always knew there was a chance that we wouldn't be coming back. We had that feeling, not all of us had that feeling tonight, and some of us just weren't lucky enough." That managed to pacify Barnes Wallace a little bit. But his daughter, Mary, could tell me that he lived with it right up until the time he died.
I asked Johnny what the mood was like after the completion of the raid.
I would describe it as emotional satisfaction. Satisfaction because of what had been achieved. Emotional because of the losses that it had caused. Because, of course, it was many people, some of their closest friends amongst those that were dead.
The Dam Busters raid struck a big blow against Nazi Germany, killing 1,300 people, creating severe floods and hampering German war production. But to Johnny and the other participants, the magnitude of the operation wasn't immediately apparent.
I don't think we realised how important it was until perhaps the next morning when we saw the paper headlines. Christ, did we do that? That sort of reaction. I'm sure we were all gratified at the result and some of the problems which it had caused to Hitler. I have a pet hate, and you have to excuse this. It's what I call retrospective historians, because after the war, there were a few of them who insisted that the damage raid should never have taken place. It didn't achieve anything, it cost far too much money, it cost far too many lives, and it detracted aircraft from the bomber offensive. I used to say, as a younger man, if I ever met one of those people, I'd hope my hands were tied behind my back because I wouldn't be quite sure what I'd do with them. But I just asked them two questions. Were you there? Were you personally aware of the conditions and the factors at that time? The answer to both those questions is no. So keep your bloody mouth shut. And my own reaction to the raid itself, I think there are at least 4 good reasons why it was a success. And the first is that it proved to Hitler and the German hierarchy that what they thought was impregnable could be breached, destroyed by the RAF. Second is, although it didn't delay the armament production as much as we would like to have done, it did delay it by some degree. Thirdly, it meant that the skilled workmen who were busy working on other war projects, notably the Atlantic Wall against invasion, had to be brought back to repair the dams. I think fourthly, probably more importantly, the moral effect it had on the people of this country was absolutely, absolutely uplifting. That, combined with the recent Alamein success, at least gave an indication that perhaps the war could be won, that we were winning in some places. And it gave a big uplift, I'm sure, to the morale of the British people.
One reason why the Dam Busters continue to fascinate us today is a classic 1955 film of the raid. I was keen to ask Johnny what he thought about the dramatised version of the events.
It was pretty good. And I have to say that I think Michael Redgrave's portrayal of Barnes Wallis was absolutely superb. I think the raid itself was pretty accurate. My disappointment was it made little or no mention of the Zorpa Dam at all. But then I have to accept that the purpose of the film basically was to demonstrate the bouncing bomb and the actual breaching of the dams. Since we achieved neither of those things, it wasn't part and parcel of the film.
After the Dam Busters raid, Johnny was one of 34 members of the operation who visited Buckingham Palace to receive an award. In his case, the Distinguished Flying Medal. He continued to take part in bombing raids with his crew until April 1944, by which time his wife Gwyn was expecting their first child.
Joe pulled me aside one day in April and he said, "Johnny, Gwyn must be worried stiff about whether this child's ever going to have a father or whether she's going to have a husband. You've got to give her a break. Pack it up now." He made me realise that I had other responsibilities besides fighting the war. And much as I didn't want to leave the crew, I realised that what he was saying was right. So I left the crew.
After the war, Johnny continued to work with the RAF until the early 1960s, before becoming a teacher in later life. He remained in contact with several other members of the raid, in particular his pilot Joe McCarthy, who died in 1998. Nowadays, as Britain's last dam buster, Johnny finds himself talking about the raid on quite a regular basis. In recent years, he has been interviewed by both Peter Jackson and Stephen Fry as part of their research for a remake of the Dam Busters film. In the remake, he's been assured the Zorpa raid will feature more prominently than in the 1955 version. A few years ago, Johnny's achievements were recognised with an invitation to Windsor Castle and an audience with the Queen, together with Johnny's son Morgan. For Johnny, it was an unforgettable experience.
She was standing in the room when we got there. And she put me at ease straight away. And I thanked her for the honour and the privilege of the audience. And she said, "Look, let's sit down." And she got some chairs arranged around there. She sat in an armchair rather like this. I sat in the one next to her. Morgan sat on my left. The other two sat just across the way. And she said, "I've heard something about you, but I'd rather like to hear it from yourself." So I started to talk. I was amazed how easy it was to talk to her without gasping and without feeling agitated in any way. She just sat there and listened, intercepted where she felt necessary. She even laughed at any jokes that I cracked. That has to be the highlight of my life. Absolutely wonderful. It really was.
That was Johnny Johnson, Britain's last dam buster. If you'd like to know more about the Dam Busters raid, then check out our May issue, which is out now. Also in the magazine, 9 leading historians dispel common misconceptions about the Second World War, and we uncover the secrets of Rome's gladiators. Our May issue is on sale now in all good newsagents and in our several digital versions. And now we have a short advertisement break.
Listen to a life by subscribing to Oxford Dictionary of National Biography's renowned podcast. The Oxford DNB offers over 58,500 biographies of people who shaped all aspects of British history worldwide from the Romans to the 21st century. Each fortnight, you can download a life story of one of Britain's greats. We've Boudicca to Bobby Moore, Mrs. Simpson to Mills and Boone, and current favourites include Roald Dahl, Guy Fawkes, George Orwell, and J.R.R. Tolkien. Here's an extract from our podcast on Antarctic explorer Captain Robert Scott.
Of the many public memorials erected to commemorate Scott after 1913, the statue by Kathleen Scott in Waterloo Place, London, is the best known. Behind the heroic image which it portrays lay a complex and contradictory individual. Of medium height, not physically strong, yet possessed of impressive stamina, Scott was by nature insecure and self-doubting, the victim of depressive moods and bouts of indolence. Yet he was ever alert to these disabilities and strove to triumph over them, supported by a deep-rooted sense of justice and a trust in the dispensations of Providence.
Individual biographies are available to download free of charge by visiting www.oxforddmb.com.
Next Wednesday at 9 p.m, BBC Four will be broadcasting a new documentary from naval historian Sam Willis. Entitled Nelson's Caribbean Hellhole, it will tell the story of the excavation of a mass grave site in Antigua that dates back to the time when the island was a colony of Britain. Sorry, I spoke to Sam about the documentary and the excavations, and I also asked him what involvement Nelson might have had in this story. So we're talking here about a mass grave site that was discovered in Antigua. How did we find out about this grave?
Antigua is one of the most extraordinary places. It is littered with archaeology because it was so central to the development of the British Empire in the 18th century, and it was mostly untouched, the archaeology. There was a hurricane, and the hurricane forced a great deal of water across a sand dune. The water then collected behind the sand dune and naturally found its way back to the sea, and in doing so it cut a river through the sand dune, and in doing so it washed all of these fragments of human bones onto the beach. There were fingers and toes poking out of the sand. A child tried to put a beach umbrella in and couldn't because there was a skull under the sand. They found a collection from, eight or so different bodies, literally just washed up on the beach. So they brought in Dr. Reg Murphy, who's the archaeological expert at English Harbour in Antigua, which is where the British used to have a major naval dockyard. And what they wanted to do then was to do a more structured archaeological investigation into what actually was going on in these sand dunes. So with an international team of archaeologists, we got there and we did two test pits on the top of these sand dunes. These are sand dunes behind Galleon Beach, which is the beach opposite English Harbour. It's a magnificent Caribbean idyllic stretch of sand. And in the first of these trenches, we didn't find what we were expecting to at all. We found some evidence of pre-Columbian Indian stone tools and shells which had been carved into tools, and some evidence of some fires. So we didn't find any bodies at all. But then we opened up another trench and we found eight. And it was a trench 1.5 meters by 1.5 meters. And we ran out of time. We had to stop. There were still bones coming out underneath all of the skeletons that we had removed. So an extraordinary sight. And we then tried to explore what was going on. This is a place that we associate with absolute luxury. It's an extraordinary place to go. It's a home of rock stars. It's a home of the yachting fraternity. But when Nelson was there at an early part of his career, he described it as an infernal hole. So we were exploring how did these bodies fit into this picture? What were they doing there? And to try and paint a more detailed picture of life in the Caribbean, and especially in Antigua in the 18th century.
Did you manage to discover who these bodies were? Were they British or were they local?
We do not know exactly who they were. There is an interesting account of a ship which we think they were associated with. Well, see, one of the things about these bodies is that they are not buried in the naval cemetery, and they're not buried in the army cemetery. The army cemetery at the top of Shirley Heights overlooking English Harbour, the naval cemetery behind the naval hospital just by the naval dockyard. It's a separate location, and they're not in a cemetery. Now, we know in 1793, so this is the beginning of the French Revolutionary War, a ship called HMS Experiment came into Antigua, and she was so riddled with sickness, her crew so ruined by sickness, that she had to be helped into the harbour by sailors from another ship. Those sailors that had gone aboard the experiment then brought the disease back onto their ship, and all of their sailors then contracted it. And it was known as the Boulam fever, a fever which came from Boulam in Africa, and then spread throughout the Caribbean, but particularly devastated Antigua. So we suspect that these bodies might have been associated with HMS experiments, this ship that came in carrying the illness, or perhaps with other ships around there. So I think it's likely that the bodies that were buried there were already dead when they came in. So we haven't got people dying on board the ship and then buried. We think they might have died and then all been carried off and buried together at once.
So there's still a real mystery attached to these bodies.
There is a real mystery. I mean, we think they're very obviously sailors, some of them, because they've been buried in hammocks. Their shoulders are slumped, their chins are pressed down against their chests, their ankles are very close together in that classic kind of skeletal shape you'd get if you'd been wrapped up in a canvas hammock. Others, there's also evidence of coffin wood. There was evidence of pearl buttons. So perhaps some sort of different status going on. What we're more likely to get the real information out of is through an chemical analysis of their bones, and the preliminary findings are suggesting that a lot of them had actually got lead poisoning. Now, we think this is a separate story to the story of the Boulam fever. I don't think they died of lead poisoning, but this whole question of lead poisoning is absolutely fascinating to do with life in the West Indies. They are certainly not the only skeletons that have been discovered on Antigua which are showing signs of lead poisoning. And it seems to me that this suffering from lead poisoning was very much a part of sailors and soldiers' lives in the Caribbean at the time. We think that the lead was getting into their bodies through the water systems, and perhaps through what's called new rum. So that's it's a rum that has not spent 2 or 3 years developing. It was a very, very cheap, easy to access. And we think that the lead was in that rum, and certainly in the water systems, because they use lead to line water tanks. There was guttering, all of these things that they collected rainwater. And the sailors were drinking it. So not only were they suffering from malaria and scurvy, and they were threatened by typhus and yellow fever, but they all had lead poisoning. They must have felt appalling all the time.
So, like you said, it's such a different image from that of a modern paradise.
Yes, I mean, particularly on this beach. What was interesting is that when we said to some of the locals, you know, are you surprised that we found loads of bodies on this beach? No, they weren't surprised at all. There are local stories associated of ghosts on that beach, which was one of the most extraordinary things to have discovered. So they weren't surprised at all. And none of the locals go there. They all go to a beach around the corner. So it's full of tourists burning themselves pink with lying essentially on a gravesite, which apparently the locals seem to know about.
And you mentioned Nelson before. Would these bodies have been put in there around the time Nelson was involved with the island?
Very possibly. So we either think it was from this Boulam fever, this strange fever that came in from Africa in the 1790s. But equally, they could be there from the 1780s, which is when Nelson was in Antigua. It's a really interesting part of his career that most people associate Nelson with, you know, fighting the forces of Napoleon in the Mediterranean and in the Atlantic around Gibraltar and Trafalgar. But an early, significant and very formative part of his career was spent in the Caribbean, and it was spent in Antigua, and it's where he met his first wife, Frances Nisbet. So he was there in the 1780s, and there's the gap between the 80s and the 90s, I think, is too small for us to be able to say what period these guys came from. What we have done, though, is looked at the muster books of HMS Experiment up in Kew in the National Archives, and they very much bring this story of the ship being struck by disease to life, where you see about 60% of the crew dying in 2 weeks. So to have so many bodies buried on the beach from a period around which we know that the experiment and the whole British squadron there was suffering from this disease. It does seem to make sense. It does seem to tick a lot of the boxes. And that muster book gives us names of the dead. And interestingly, because the squadron was then so bad, poorly manned, the ships had to go back out to sea and then sail around the harbour to press sailors. And they sailed all the way down to Barbados to press more sailors. So the press gang was very much associated with this death. I mean, people often, I think, associate the press gang with the start of wars, generating huge numbers of men to go and fill all these ships. But it's intricately linked in the Caribbean to death. Sailors aboard died. The Navy had to go out and find more sailors and press gang them. And very interestingly, many of those sailors who were pressed ran away within weeks of joining the experiment. So they get on the experiment, they realise that half the crew's dead, everyone else looks terrible, and they I'm not going to stay here, and off they go. So the muster books show them as being pressed in Barbados or St John's in Antigua, and then 2 weeks later there's a mark for R, which means that they've run.
And so perhaps it's not such a surprise that Nelson has such negative views about the place if there was all this illness and sailors running away and things like that.
No, not at all. I mean, also, if you go to English Harbour now, it's full of these mega yachts, and it's very sort of a manicured place. It's very much presented for the public as an important part of Antiguan heritage. But it's shiny, it's clean. It's completely different to what it used to have been. It was an industrial dockyard. It was an industrial centre. They were burning sulphur to clean the ships. It would have stunk. There were furnaces for making anchors and chains. And you've also got huge numbers of ships there. You know, the biggest ships have got 800 or 1,000 men on, and all of their sewage is just going straight into the harbour. So now it's crystal clear waters, but it would have been an open sewer essentially in the 18th century. It's very still. It has mountains that surround it. It's like being in the center of a volcano. You don't get the refreshing tropical breezes that you do up on the hills in Antigua. It's a still, dead, hot place. And now they've still got the swamps and they've still got the mosquitoes, but they don't carry malaria. But it was. I mean, you can really imagine it being fetid and being hot. While he was there, Nelson regularly had buckets of seawater poured over his head in the morning to try and make himself feel better and cool down.
What were all these British sailors doing in Antigua? Was it the slave trade? Was it sugar that brought them there?
It was sugar. I mean, particularly when Nelson was there, he was there to enforce the Navigation Acts, which were acts that insisted that British goods were only carried and traded by British crews in British ships. And the Americans, in particular, were outraged by this because they wanted to trade between the British sugar islands and America. Antigua is a sugar island. It was a sugar island, and as was Barbados. They're flat. They're good for growing sugar. They're not mountainous islands like Dominique, like St. Lucia. It's, you know, all of these Caribbean islands are different. But Antigua and Barbados, they're flat. They're in good positions and they're brilliant for growing sugar. And sugar is what made the economy go round. It's easy to just think of it in very purely economic terms. But to protect that sugar trade, the government was sending thousands and thousands of sailors out to the Caribbean. A lot of them were dying, and they just kept on sending more sailors, and they kept on dying. And so they kept on sending more. And I think that's a very shocking approach to human life, which raises so many questions for us now. What were they doing? Why were they doing it? What was the reaction? How did they react when they found out that half a crew of HMS Experiment died? I mean, what was the reaction of the politicians? Did they pause and think about it, or did they just send off another 500 men? So I think there's a fascinating story linked to the sugar trade that hasn't really been explored properly. But hopefully, by doing this archaeology in Antigua, we can really open up questions like this to investigation.
And I suppose the programmes as well will bring it to a much wider audience.
Yes, very much so. And there's an extraordinary amount of archaeology. One of my favourite places in Antigua that really, really needs looking after, it needs recording, it needs sorting out, is this thing called the water catchment. There are no rivers, large rivers or lakes on Antigua. So all of the water, all of the fresh water had to be collected from the sky. It rains and they built these huge water catchments. They're kind of like empty, flat swimming pools that all drained all the water down into big water tanks. Now, the sailors who were going there to collect water carved their names into the walls of the water catchment behind the naval dockyard. And so you've got names of these men, the year that they were there, the name of their ship. So HMS Roebuck, 1745, and their names. And it's extraordinary seeing the variety of the handwriting. It's extraordinary seeing how much these men wanted to say that we have been here. So if this program not only raises the question of what was going on in the Royal Navy in Antigua, hopefully it will really help promote Antiguan archaeology. It'll get more people involved. It'll allow us to understand the sources for archaeology we've got there and to record them and to protect them for future generations.
That was Sam Willis. Nelson's Caribbean Hellhole will be showing on BBC 4 next Wednesday at 9 p.m. And that is almost all for this week. Do let us know what you think on email, podcast@historyextra.com, or on social media. We're on Twitter @HistoryExtra, and we're on facebook.com/HistoryExtra. Plus, you can keep up with all our latest blogs, quizzes, galleries, and plenty more on our website, which is historyextra.com. Just before we go, I'd like to give you a quick heads up about a couple of lectures we're running in the next few months. On Wednesday the 8th of May at Apsley House in London, Simon Thurley will explore the history of heritage protection in Britain, to be followed by a drinks reception and a special exhibition viewing at Wellington Arch. Then on the 8th of July at the British Academy, also in London, Anthony Beaver and Roger Morehouse will be discussing some of the latest ideas about the Second World War. For details of both events and for tickets, please visit historyextra.com/lectures. Next week, we'll be discussing the history of Britain's royals with Lucy Worsley and revisiting Europe in 1913. Do join us for that. The History Extra weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Jack Fletcher.